Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know who you are?
Steven is my name. Even Steven.
Will you say something, Steven?
Steven or else media.
Deep in the far reaches of outer space, there once existed a civilization far more advanced than our own. The inhabitants of planet Krypton. The planet was governed by a revered council of elders, wise men, supermen. And yet, for all their wisdom, they could not see that their planet was doomed. Only the visionary scientist Jor-El and his wife Lara sensed that the end was near. Though it was too late to save themselves, there was a chance to save Kal-El, their infant son. And so, as his parents watched in sadness, Kal-El left the ill-fated Krypton bound for a new home.
From Steven or Else Media, this is Season 1 of The Comic Book Show, Episode 1, From Out the Green Dawn.
What is your favorite thing in the world?
Comics.
Yes.
Comics!
No, wait, it's all about comics.
Comics! Hello and welcome to The Comic Book Show, the podcast that's a show about comics. I'm your host, my name is Steven, and here on Season 1, I'm kicking off this new podcast with 6 episodes talking about my most favorite super dude, Superman. More specifically, we're going to be talking about the 6-issue miniseries, The Man of Steel from 1986, which was my first introduction to the comic book version of Superman. Now, I had been watching Superman on the Super Friends since, I don't know, the late 70s, but until 1986, I'd never actually read any Superman comics. Well, that may not be entirely true. I may have read the occasional Superman comic before The Man of Steel hit the shelves. Maybe. I mean, it's possible. The problem is that I honestly don't know because my brain doesn't work that way anymore.
My mind is a raging torrent, flooded with rivulets of thought cascading into a waterfall of creative alternatives.
I am an old man, and there's all kinds of stuff from my past that I just can't fully remember. And frankly, there's a big bunch of memories floating around in my cranial soup bowl that, well, I might have a memory that at its core is fact. It may have been built from a kernel of truth, but the rest of the memory is pure fabrication, created by an aging brain that's just trying to fill in the blanks as best as it can. In other words, I'm not always comfortable these days relying solely on my memory. Thankfully, that's where the internet comes in. And thanks to the internet, what I do know is that in 1985, DC Comics blew up their fictional comic book universe and replaced it with something new, all in an effort to make their comics a bit easier to get into for new readers. This was, of course, Crisis on Infinite Earths, and the Man of Steel miniseries was a result. A reboot of Superman, written and drawn by John Byrne, who had spent the previous decade rising to superstardom over there at Marvel Comics on such titles as the X-Men, the Avengers, and Captain America. Not to mention his 6-year run on the Fantastic Four. Well, that's a time that many consider to be the second golden age for that title. I mean, John Byrne was the guy at the time, and his departure from Marvel for DC caused quite the stir.
Flashy, making the scene, flaunting convention.
For me, when The Man of Steel was being published, I was just 14 years old. I didn't have a job, and I wasn't old enough to drive, so beyond my subscriptions to G.I. Joe and Captain America, I was actually dependent on my older brother when it came to reading comics. Meaning that at the time, my brother was 17. He had a job, a driver's license, and a pull list at our local comic book store, Quality Comics. So whatever he was buying, I was reading. And while he wasn't much of a DC guy, John Byrne was reason enough for him to start picking up Superman, beginning with The Man of Steel.
You realize The Man of Steel isn't just a clever nickname, right?
From the time I watched my first episode of The Super Friends when I was just a little guy, Superman has always been my number one most favorite superhero of all time. I just don't think I truly realized that fact until I first started reading John Byrne's reboot in 1986. For me, Byrne's Superman is my Superman. And so, yeah, it just made sense for me to talk about the Man of Steel for this first season of the comic book show. Now, full disclosure, the bulk of each of the six episodes that make up season one were originally recorded in 2023. They were originally released on the Superman Super Show feed, and they were meant to be the first six episodes to a long-running podcast, Superman or Else. But considering that it's been nearly a year and I've yet to record more than those six episodes, I figured, you know, rather than have them sit there on my hard drive, let's get them out there. So they have been remixed and re-edited. I've recorded new stuff, obviously, and I'm now going to present them here to you. In each episode, I'll give you a short synopsis of the issue, and then I'm really going to dive in and go page by page and comb through the story as I give you all of my thoughts and junk.
What a piece of junk!
And so, without any more ado, let's talk about The Man of Steel number one. This issue hit the stands on July 10th, 1986. It sold for just 75 cents, and it is entitled From Out the Green Dawn. It was written and penciled by John Byrne, Dick Giordano was the inker, the letters were by John Costanza, and the colors were by Tom Ziuko. The planet Krypton has been plagued by a green death, which has poisoned millions. Scientist Jor-El has discovered that a chain reaction inside the planet's core is responsible, and the pressure in the core will soon lead to a catastrophic explosion. Unable to save himself or his people, Jor-El is able to attach a rocket to the birthing matrix of his unborn son, Kal-El. Just before the planet is destroyed, Jor-El sends his son to Earth. 18 years later, Clark Kent of Smallville High is a football hero. After winning the final game of the season, his father, Jonathan Kent, takes him to an abandoned field and shows him the rocket that brought him to Earth. Jonathan explains that he and Martha found the ship and the baby inside soon after it crash-landed. Clark learns for the first time that he is not the natural son of the Kents. He also decides that he should use his powers for the good of the world and prepares to leave Smallville. 7 years later, Clark returns to Smallville and tells his parents about a recent incident in Metropolis. Though he has been secretly using his powers to prevent disasters and help people for several years, no one has actually seen him. However, when a NASA space plane was involved in a mid-air collision, Clark was forced to act publicly to save the plane and everyone on board, including reporter Lois Lane. After landing the plane, Clark was mobbed and retreated to Smallville for his parents' counsel. The Kents help Clark construct a costumed identity so that he can act publicly. As Clark Kent, he begins wearing glasses, slicking his hair back, and stooping to alter his appearance. But in order to help the world without people knowing his true identity, Clark puts on the new costume and takes the name Superman. All right, so we're going to start with the cover. And this particular issue is not only known as the issue that kicks off the post-crisis Superman titles, it also sports two different covers, one of which is a variant cover. But here's the thing. It's not just any old run-of-the-mill variant cover. And though it isn't the first variant cover to ever be published, it is the first to be published with the sole intention of selling more copies of the issue. I'll explain.
Great. I'll get comfortable.
By the time Man of Steel number one landed in July of 1986, variant covers were not an unknown thing, but they certainly weren't what we think of nowadays, you know, when it comes to alternate or gimmicky covers. In fact, the first so-called variant covers were published for reasons that turned out to be quite logical.
Logical, but unnecessary.
For example, back in the mid-70s, Marvel Comics decided that they wanted to raise the prices of their titles by a nickel, from 25 cents to 30 cents. But they really weren't sure how that was going to go down with their readers. And so they picked a small test market. And for a few months in 1976, those test regions got Marvel Comics issues with 30 cents as the price point on the cover, while the rest of the country got issues with 25 cents on the cover. Those titles that were released in those test markets that showed the 30 cents on the cover, they are technically variant covers. And people do collect them. Another example would be the covers for issues sold on newsstands versus those sold in the direct market. The term newsstand, of course, is kind of a catch-all term that would include grocery stores, convenience stores, and even bookstores. Basically, any retail outlet that sold comics that at the time were not specialty shops or what we call comic book stores. And they were typically displayed with the magazines and the newspapers, thus newsstand. Now, the issues that were sold in comic book stores were direct market books, meaning that the comic book distributors sold directly to the comic book stores and they gave them wholesale pricing, or basically the comic book stores bought their issues from the distributors at cheaper prices than the outlets that sold the comics on the newsstands. On the flip side, the outlets that sold comics on the newsstands were able to return unsold copies back to the distributor to recoup some of that cost. And they did that by removing the covers from each of the issues that they were returning, and they just sent back the covers, which, you know, if you've ever run into a box of comics at a garage sale or a flea market and most of the books in the box didn't have covers, they were probably newsstand issues that were, quote, returned. Anyway, to avoid any shady characters from trying to return direct market books and get the best of both worlds, you know, cheaper pricing on the issues and some money back on the unsold copies, well, steps had to be made to differentiate the newsstand covers from the direct market covers. One of the more simple solutions was the barcode. Issues that sold on the newsstands had barcodes on their covers, while the direct editions, those sold in comic book stores, they had the box on the cover where a barcode would be, but would instead have a bit of art in that box, like Spider-Man's masked face for the Marvel issues, as an example. There were other more subtle changes DC and Marvel would use based on which distributor they used. And these two would be examples of comic book issues with variant covers. With Man of Steel number one, however, DC thought it would be fun to release two different covers to try and entice the collectors to purchase one of each and thus sell more copies. One version of the cover, cover A, is a close-up of Clark Kent's chest from neck to navel, basically. And on the cover, Clark is pulling open his suit and tie to reveal the Superman costume underneath. The other cover, cover B, falls in line with the trade dress of the following five issues of the series. And that's a cover that's split down the middle. And on one side, we see what is, in essence, a scene from the book, while on the other side, we see a character from the issue. In this case, on the right-hand side of the cover is the rocket zooming away from Krypton as the planet is ready to explode behind it. And on the left side, we get Clark Kent pulling open his shirt to reveal the Superman costume beneath. Now, for me, I am a big fan of cover A. Cover B is fine. I mean, it does its job, I guess. But had I walked into a comic book store on July 10th, 1986, and I saw both of the covers on the shelf, but I could only afford to get one of them, I would have gone with cover A. However, having said that, being the kind of guy that I am, a guy who kind of likes things to match, who digs themes, if I had gone into that comic shop with just enough money to buy one cover, and if I was armed with the knowledge that the next five issues of the series would be set up in the same way as cover B, well, I would have picked up cover B, you know, just so I'd know that all six issues, bagged and boarded in my long box, were all part of the same visual theme. The Comic Book Show will return after these messages.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And now, back to the Comic Book Show.
Anyway, if you want to know more about the history of variant covers, I suggest that you check out a YouTube video called The Rise and Fall and Rise Again of Variant and Gimmick Covers. That's over there on the Comic Tropes channel, and I'll include a link in the show notes. But that's where I got most of my information for this part of the episode.
Give that back.
It's mine.
It is not yours. You stole it.
Never.
Give it back to me.
All right.
All right. So let's get into the book itself. This issue is separated into various chapters or sections or whatever you want to call it. And it starts out with the prologue, which is set on Krypton in the past. We meet Jor-El, who has returned from some kind of journey. He returns back to wherever it is he lives with Lara. And there's a couple of robots there. One is named Kellex, and the other's named Kellor. They refer to Jor-El as my lord and master and all that stuff. So they're very subservient to Jor-El. And he immediately asks Kellex, where is the child? And Kellex tells him that he followed his instructions from earlier, and he placed the matrix in the third level laboratory. And then he calls him sire. And Jor-El tells him, when the Lady Lara calls, please guide her to me. And so he goes into this laboratory, and there's this big black ball on a stand. And inside is it's his son, his unborn son. And so Krypton at this point has developed into a society that is very advanced compared to even where we are on Earth now. But they're very wholly dependent upon their technology. They have evolved into a race of people that are practically emotionless. And when a man and woman are married, it's an arranged thing. And if they want to have children, it's not, you know, they don't put on some Barry White and get into the bedroom and do a little something something between the sheets. It's very clinical. The man provides his part and the woman provides her part, and they goes into a gestation matrix, and the child is gestated outside of the womb. And so that's where little Kal-El is at this point. He is unborn. He's a fetus. He's a developing fetus inside of this gestation matrix. And Jor-El is kind of looking at him. And then Lara shows up, and she's just in a panic, and she sees the matrix there, and she's, oh my gosh, it's true. You really did it. You sent one of our servants to remove the matrix from the gestation chambers. And he's basically like, yeah, I did. I am entitled to do so. I'm the child's father. By Kryptonian law, I have the right to do that. And she reminds him that that's a law that hasn't been invoked in centuries. And she wants to know what the frick is going on, basically. And she's basically saying that by doing this, by taking the Matrix from the gestation chambers, that Jor-El is endangering their son. And Jor-El's like, no, I'm not. I'm actually saving him. And so this is when we learn that there is this plague going on all across Krypton that is making the Kryptonians sick and killing them. Lara brings this up in kind of a, you know, oh, well, if you're talking about the plague, good Lord, settle down. Our greatest physicians are working on a cure right now, you know, acting like he is basically just blowing this out of proportion, which Jor-El explains to her that the plague, the Green Death, is, it's not what everybody thinks it is. And it's just the tip of the iceberg. Basically, he's just returned from a journey that has taken him all over Krypton. He has had this suspicion about what's happening to the planet. He's been working on it for months, and he went out to do some investigating, and he found that his suspicions were true. He tells her that, I'll just read it straight from the book, a chain reaction within the core of Krypton has caused vast pressures to build within the planet's crust. Those unnatural pressures are fusing the native elements into a new metal, a radioactive metal. It is that radiation that is killing us. And if that were not enough, the same pressures as it builds and builds within our world will soon be too much for the rocky mantle to contain. Within a day, perhaps within as little as an hour, Krypton will explode. She's very unbelieving. There has to be something we can do. It's not that final. You know, she reminds them that we as Kryptonians are the masters of this planet for thousands of years. It does not rain, but that we permit it. And now you say that the world will destroy us. And he's like, yeah. And it's probably because of all this crap that we've been doing, right? They have tried to shape this planet into what they feel the planet should be. They've tried to control Mother Nature, basically. And it's not nice to mess with Mother Nature because, you know, what they say, F around and find out. That's what's happening here. The Kryptonians have effed around for 1,000 years and now they're finding out what's going to happen. And Krypton, you know, as I said, it's gotten to this point, you know, their civilization is very, if you're a fan of Star Trek, it's very Vulcan. You know, Jor-El tells her that we have filled every nook and cranny, conquered and harnessed every force of nature. And in the end, what have we achieved? Sterility, a cold and heartless society stripped of all human feeling, all human passion and life. And Lara is just freaking out. And she says that he's speaking obscenities, basically. And he's just kind of, you know, whatever. We brought this upon ourselves. We have denied ourselves with living a full life. And now we're going to pay for it. And he explains to her that while he can't do anything to save the planet, he can save their son. He explains that the gestation matrix that little baby Kal-El has been developing in has shielded him from the radiation. So Kal-El is not going to get the radiation sickness that everybody is getting. And he also explains that the matrix is built in such a fashion that it will even survive a journey through hyperspace. And so he has built a hyper light drive that he's got his robot servants right now attaching it to the matrix, and he's going to send little baby Kal-El into space. And in fact, he has done some research and he has found this planet that he says is not unlike the Krypton of millennia past. And it's a planet that its inhabitants call Earth. And he even shows her a bit of footage or whatever. I don't know if he's using some kind of super powerful telescope or if he is able to hack into to the Earth's television feed or anything, but he shows her a field. He says it's in a nation called America in a subsection called Kansas. And you see a couple of farmers out there in the field, and one of them is holding a pitchfork that he's got a bunch of hay that he has scooped up with the pitchfork. And he's not wearing a shirt. and frickin' Laura almost faints. She screams out when she sees this and refers to this dude as a savage, a barbarian who bears his naked flesh, his hairy flesh. He touches unprocessed soil. What kind of hell do you seek to send our child into? Which is really kind of funny. And he explains to her that Earth is actually going to be a heaven for their child because it orbits a yellow sun. And Kal-El, exposed to the radiation of that star, his Kryptonian cells will become living solar batteries, making him grow ever more powerful. And in time, he will become the supreme being on that planet, almost a god. And immediately Laura's like, all right, so he's going to rule them, right? He's going to be like their leader and he's going to force them to make Earth like Krypton. And Jor-El's like, maybe, I don't know, but let's just send him there anyway and save his life. And before she can really argue, the eruptions begin. The planet's about ready to explode. The robots have just finished attaching the Matrix to this hyper light drive. And so he launches his son out into space, and we get a famous shot. We've seen it represented across all forms of media, and it's the little rocket ship zooming away as the planet explodes behind it. And we actually have one panel here. If you're not really paying attention, you'd miss it, but there is you're seeing debris, bits of the planet flying about the rocket, but there's one particular piece that seems to attach itself to the side of the rocket. And that's how the prologue ends. And I really quite enjoyed John Byrne's interpretation, I guess, of Krypton, what he has defined Krypton as. I'm not a big fan of, basically Jor-El is the only sane person, even in his own family. You know, his wife is a raving madwoman, basically, who is so stuck in tradition that she just doesn't even want to believe that anything different is possible. She's portrayed as kind of a small-minded person, which I guess pretty much everybody on Krypton was when it came to new ideas. But of course, in this day and age, with everything that we've been seeing around us, you know, stuff that's been going on for decades and hundreds and thousands of years, but how, you know, a guy like me can grow up most of his life and not even notice that it's happening because that's the way our society was created. But we have to have in this book the woman be the inferior ultimately, because she's the small-minded crazy woman who just isn't going to believe that something bad is going to happen. And, you know, the hairy barbarian and touching his hands to the unprocessed soil and
you are a barbarian
yelling at Jor-El for speaking obscenities, for daring to speak out against the way Kryptonian society was built. And you know, I'm not trying to say that John Byrne specifically sat down and said, all right, what can I do to make a woman look bad in this book? It's just that's just the way men have been taught since the dawn of time. But I think more and more men are waking up to the fact that that's not true. Anyway, we jump forward 18 years. We're now in Smallville, Kansas. Somebody save me. Chapter 1 of this issue, and it's called The Secret.
Have you heard about it? This is The Secret.
Clark is playing football. John Byrne has made Clark into a football star, basically a high school football star, which, even though this is the first origin story of Superman that I ever read, this was my introduction to Superman's origin back in 1986. I feel like everything that has, you know, every origin story that has been told since, whether it's been in the movies, probably specifically the movies, animation, TV, whatnot, teenage Clark Kent is a very unassuming boy. You know, he has these superpowers, but he's not using them to better himself. You know, he's not using them really to win the football game and stuff like that. So seeing him as a football star that people are throwing up on their shoulders after he wins the game and yelling his name and cheering, and that just feels odd to me reading it again now. But Jonathan's on the sidelines and he's watching this, and the coach tells Jonathan that boy of yours is the best. He's going to make millions as a pro. Millions! Jonathan, however, he's not too happy. He doesn't like seeing Clark using his powers
to make himself better than others. And he even points out to the coach that he, you know, there's teammates on the bench that are watching Clark win this game pretty much by himself, and they don't look happy. And when he points that out to the coach is like, ah, they're just jealous, you know? And, you know, because the coach is just happy that they're winning. He doesn't care how it happens because football is the most important thing in many Americans' lives, which is, I'm not going to judge. Anyway, Clark is getting ready to go have a soda with Alana Lang after the game, but his dad says, nah, you're coming with me. I'm taking you home. And on the ride home, Clark asks his dad, are you mad at me? And Jonathan tells him, I'm not mad. I'm disappointed. And Clark doesn't understand. He said, well, how can you be disappointed? I just won the last game of the season and I pretty much did it by myself. And Jonathan's like, yeah, I know. And that's what we need to talk about. And then that's when he takes him out to this field, a field that he says that he has left to lay fallow for the last 18 years. He's put the nastiest barbed wire fence he could find around it. He's put up no trespassing signs and he wants to keep people out of this field. And Clark even mentions, well, this is the field you told me never to play in when I was a little kid. Jonathan takes him to a spot in the field where there are basically two big doors or a big slab of wood in the middle of the field. And he tells Clark to lift it up. He says, with your strength, you're more than strong enough now. You should be able to do it. And so he lifts up this big square piece of wood that's even bigger than your typical garage door. And we find a big hole underneath it, and inside the hole is the rocket. And that's when Jonathan tells Clark that this is where they found him. And Clark's like, found me? You mean I'm adopted?
I'm not adopted. I'm asking Mom.
You know, which is really kind of funny because imagine you're 18 years old. You're feeling pretty good about yourself. You just won the football game. Everybody loves you. And your dad takes you out into a field where there's a freaking rocket ship in a crater and says, yeah, this is where we found you. This is where you came from. And you don't think to yourself, oh, hold on, I was in a freaking rocket ship as a baby? No, his thought is I was adopted. That's what he's dwelling on, which is kind of funny. But Jonathan tells him the story of how 18 years ago they saw something fall out of the sky and they, you know, in the middle of the night, and they drove out to where they saw it land, and they found the rocket. And inside the rocket is baby Clark. Now, I should point out here, it's very important to note that in John Byrne's retelling of Superman's origin, you know, I talked about how he was in this birthing matrix, this gestation matrix. He was not born. Basically, he was born on Earth rather than on Krypton. In every story that's been told before this point, and frankly, there's origin stories that have been told after this point, many of them, Kal-El is a baby. Jor-El takes his infant son and places it in a rocket and sends it to Earth. But in this case, he sends his unborn gestating fetus of a son, and it is then born on Earth. And the child happens to be born ultimately when they approach the rocket and Jonathan puts his hands on the matrix. That's when the matrix opens up, and that is Clark being born into the world. So that was done on purpose, of course. They wanted John, well, I don't know if it was what John Byrne wanted or if it was what DC wanted, but ultimately the idea here is that this gives Superman more of a connection with Earth. Yeah, he's from Krypton, he's an alien, but he was born on Earth and raised by a couple of good citizens in the state of Kansas. But one of the funny things about this scene is that while Jonathan does mention that for all they know, this could be a Martian, you know, this little baby could be a Martian. And Martha tells him that he's being ridiculous. Look at this child. It's obviously a human. And so they kind of assume their assumption here at this point, and this is also an important note, their assumption is that this rocket didn't come from outer space. It's maybe Russian. That the Russians sent a baby into space, basically, because Jonathan mentions, you know, well, they've been sending dogs and monkeys and stuff up there. So I guess, and Martha's just horrified that anybody would send a baby up into space, and that they're going to take this baby home and they're going to raise this child as their own. And if the Russians come looking for them, well, they're going to get Martha's foot in their butt is what's going to happen here, is basically what she's saying. And then Jonathan recounts certain moments in Clark's life to Clark about how, well, first he explains that literally right after they brought baby Clark home from the crash site, that Kansas got hit by a massive blizzard that kept them trapped in their home. Well, actually, they don't say that. They said they didn't get back into Smallville for 5 months. Now, I grew up in Kansas. I've lived all my life in Kansas. We had some pretty bad winters as a child. And granted, I did live in town, but I don't recall ever having the kind of snowstorm that farmers, people who lived in any of the rural areas around here, couldn't get into town for 5 months. Now, again, he doesn't say they were trapped there. He just says it was the worst storm of the century and we didn't get back into Smallville for 5 months. I don't know. But I mean, John Byrne is from Canada, and I can see that happening in Canada, maybe up north, but not in the part of Kansas where I'm from anyways, which is Eastern Kansas. Most of Kansas that you see portrayed in media is going to be Western Kansas, where it's very flat. Anyway, because they were unable to get into Smallville for 5 months, by the time they did, they just told people that Martha had been pregnant. They just weren't telling anybody, and she had the baby at home during the blizzard, and everybody was like, all right, cool. Because, he mentions, after two miscarriages and one stillbirth, our friends were just thrilled as could be to meet little Clark Kent. And then this is where he starts to recount moments from Clark's life growing up to Clark, which was kind of silly, but Clark even points it out to him at one point, because he's just basically pointing out how we brought you home and for a number of years, you were just a perfect little boy and we didn't have any reason to suspect that you had superpowers. But when Clark was 8, Jonathan was out in the truck going to town or coming back from town, and Clark was cutting through old man McCullough's pasture on the way to or from school, and McCullough's prize bull charges Clark and tramples him in the field. And of course, Jonathan freaks out, runs across the field, expecting to find at best a broken and bloody little boy still alive, but at worst, of course, his son dead in this pasture. But he finds him just perfectly fine. His clothes are torn, but no worse for the wear. And he talks about how other powers started to manifest themselves. You know, they show him, you know, maybe a couple of years later, lifting up the truck to get a ball from underneath. His X-ray vision came into play when he was a teenager, and the same when he learned that he could fly, which was because he was out running around with his dog.
He was a mean dog.
Old Rusty, as Jonathan calls him. And for some reason, he's running next to, well, it's just a ditch. He's not like on the side of a cliff or anything. He's just running alongside a ditch that maybe has a 2 foot drop maybe. And the dog jumps on him because he's so happy to see Clark, and he knocks Clark into the ditch. But instead of falling into the ditch, he just floats there. And that's when he learns he can fly. And then, of course, it's at this point that Clark's like, why are you telling me all this, Pa? I know most of it, except about this rocket ship, of course. And Clark goes to investigate the rocket. He goes to get closer to it. But as he gets next to the rocket, he suddenly becomes very sick, weak and dizzy, and he's about to pass out. And so Jonathan takes him home. We do see, again, it could be fairly easy to miss. There's just this green thing in the bottom corner of this panel that's attached to the side of this rocket. And it could be, you know, if you're not really paying attention, you could just mistake it for a weird way to color a splotch on the side of the rocket. It looks like a green piece of dirt, frankly, with cobwebs coming off it or something. But as they're driving away, we see a mysterious shadowy figure in a coat and a hat watching them drive away. And no idea who that is. They don't tell us at all in this issue. I'm assuming we will learn who that is later. Well, Jonathan gets Clark home, and as they pull up, Martha comes out on the porch and she says, "You told him?" And Jonathan says, "I told him." And Clark says, "He told me." And that just makes me laugh. I don't know why. It's just very funny. "You told him?" "I told him. He told me." Very funny for some reason. Just makes me laugh. But it's at this moment they go into the house. Martha's very worried that Clark is going to hate them for keeping this secret. And Clark assures her that he could never hate them. You know, they're his parents. It doesn't matter where he came from. They raised him. They are his parents. But it's at that moment, well, it's, you know, the ride home and thinking everything over and his powers and how he was using them to win at a football game. And he mentions that they have told him a number of times that he should never use his special abilities to make himself better than other people, which in turn makes them feel useless. And that's exactly what was happening there on the football field. Those other players were angry because they felt useless.
It's pretty goddamn useless.
And so he decides at that point that he's going to go out into the world. He's going to leave Smallville and he's going to seek out, quote, people and places that need somebody who can do the things I can do, but I have to do it in secret. The world mustn't ever know it's me. It must always seem like good luck or nature. And then he leaves. And I'll admit that the first time I read this, I guess I just wasn't paying attention because, granted, we know that, well, the football game was the last game of the year. Football is a winter sport, right? So the school year isn't over. And it almost appears, if you're reading this fast, that he decides at that moment, I'm going to go out into the world, because then he leaves the house. And then we go to the next chapter, which is 7 years later. So I know that the first time I read this, I was like, so what? Is he just not going to finish school? He's just leaving? But he's actually saying that he's going to head out tomorrow, but there's somebody he has to go see first, and that's why he's leaving. But still, unless Smallville ends their school year with a football game, it's just, there's still school left. But again, comics.
Comics!
We're just going to assume that the Smallville, around that area, their football season ends on the last day of school. Otherwise, yeah, he's leaving school to go do this.
The Comic Book Show will return after these messages. And now, back to the Comic Book Show.
So that's the end of that chapter. We get to chapter 2, The Exposure. It's now 7 years later. Martha is sitting at the kitchen table and she's clipping out articles from newspapers. Jonathan is just getting up for the morning. And we learn that Martha has kept a scrapbook over these last 7 years of various happenings throughout the world that seem as if, again, good luck or nature saved a town or saved a person or helped people. Some of these headlines are floodwaters diverted, town saved as hillside dams river. Bridge holds to last minute, collapse waits for workers to get clear. Driver saved as vessel refloats. Child saved from mountain fall, reports flying angel caught him as he fell. So these aren't like reports of a mysterious man who cannot be identified, who is going around saving people. These are, again, what seems to be good luck or nature diverting disaster. And Martha knows that it's actually Clark out there doing good. And so she's been collecting these articles. Jonathan worries, what if some burglar broke in here and found the scrapbook? What would he make of it, Martha? And she tells him to freaking chill.
Chill, Winston.
First of all, things like that don't happen in small towns like this. And if somebody did find the scrapbook, they're just going to think that she's just some weird lady who's obsessed with disasters or disasters that didn't quite happen. They're not just going to automatically assume, oh, their son must be an alien who has superpowers. So Jonathan doesn't come off as the sharpest tool in the shed there. But he picks up the newspaper and he immediately goes, oh, it looks like we got another article for your scrapbook. And he turns it around. Mysterious Superman saves space plane. And you can see a picture. There's two photographs on the front page of the Smallville Post of a man flying away. He's very blurry, so you can't make out who he is. But they both kind of realize, people are going to know now. But then they hear a creaking from above coming from Clark's room, and they go up. I don't know what this is that Jonathan is holding. Actually, now that I'm really looking at it, it must be an axe handle. He's, you know, an axe handle without the axe head or whatever you want to call it on it.
There's nothing like a nice piece of hickory.
But he runs up to Clark's room with this axe handle ready to kick some butt. But he finds Clark in there. Clark's sitting in a chair in his room in the dark. And I really don't understand the idea behind the way this has been. I don't know if this is an inking thing or if this is how John Byrne penciled it and thus it was inked this way. But you can't see Clark's eyes. He's sitting there in the dark. His eyes are in shadow and he looks creepy. If there was no text, if I was just looking at these without any word balloons, I would assume that they heard something from upstairs. Jonathan runs up, opens the door, and there's some dude sitting there in the room, and he's about to kill everybody in the house. That's what it looks like to me. But it's Clark, and all he says to his dad is, "They wanted a piece of me, Pa. They all wanted a piece of me." And then he tells the story. He's been living in Metropolis for the past 3 years. They were celebrating their 250th anniversary of the city. And they had big events planned and whatnot. And one of them was for a experimental space plane called the Constitution. It was going to land at Metropolis Airport. That's apparently a really big deal. And the whole city turned out to watch it happen. But a small plane, a civilian craft, somehow, as Clark puts it, slipped through the security cordon and it slams into one of the wings on this space plane. So they're both going down and they're fused together at this point. The small aircraft is fused with the space plane's wing. And so now they're both going down. Clark is in the middle of the crowd and he realizes he has to do something and there's no way he's going to be able to sneak off in time to figure out a way to help them with nobody seeing them. So he literally, from the middle of the crowd, just flies up and he grabs the plane and he lands it and he's about to take off. He's like, "All right, I've done my deed." He's about to walk away. But out of the plane comes Lois Lane. "Hold it right there, Buster." And she comes over to figure out what the flip is going on because she was in the space plane. She's a reporter. She was along for the ride to get a story. And one of the astronauts that are on the plane, when it stops falling, when it rights itself, one of the astronauts can see from the belly camera that there is a man underneath the space plane. I know it's supposed to be a space shuttle, but it doesn't look like the space shuttle. And they call it a space plane. So that's what I'm going to call it. But Lois runs out to talk to this dude that can fly and can carry a space plane. And immediately their eyes meet. And you can almost hear, "Dreamweaver. I believe you can get me through the night. Something words, I don't know the words to the song." But, you know, some romantic song playing as their eyes lock and a connection is made immediately. And Clark just freaking falls in love. Love at first sight for old Clarky boy. Probably not for Lois. I don't know. But before she can really ask him any questions, suddenly they are both just mobbed by a crowd of people. And Clark is telling his parents, "They were all over me like wild animals, like maggots, clawing, pulling, screaming at me. And it was all demands. Everybody had something they wanted me to do, to say, to sell.
Superman! Superman!"
And so Clark took off. And he says he went to a mountaintop in Tibet and sat and shook with outrage and fear. Says, "They'd taken everything you've ever taught me and ripped it apart. I know I still have to use my powers to help people who really need me, but now they're going to be looking for me, expecting me, and I just don't know how to deal with it." And that's when Jonathan, who has just finished lighting his pipe, so here comes the pun, he pipes up. "Ha ha! I think I do." And that's the end of that chapter. And then we get to the epilogue, which is called The Superhero. And we learn here in what is 4 pages that the entire concept behind Superman was created just among Clark and his two parents. Martha sewed the costume together. Jonathan and Clark sat down and designed the costume and the S shield. And then Martha put it all together. And she tells him as he's putting the suit on, and I'm going to talk about that in a second, because I don't know why I never noticed it the first few times I've read this, but it for some reason really became apparent to me as I was reading this, but I'll get to that in a second. Hold on. Martha points out as he's pulling the suit on that it fits nice and snug, and that she started noticing when he was only 12 years old that cloth right up against his skin never seemed to tear or get dirty. It was only anything that was loose fitting. And then she says, besides, it shows off your muscles. And Clark goes, Ma. And then as he's pulling on his boots, Jonathan's like, gotta admit you were right about the boots, Ma. They add a nice swashbuckler look. And then they put on the cape, which Martha's worried about because it's not skin tight and it will probably tear. And Clark says, not to worry, Ma. The whole thing works just fine. It's got exactly the symbolic look I wanted. So from now on, whenever there are people who need my very special kind of help, it won't be a job for plain, ordinary Clark Kent. Turn the page, very last page, splash page, Superman flying away from the house. It'll be a job for Superman. And that's how the issue ends. Now, let me back up a moment because there were a couple things I wanted to point out here in this epilogue. First, John Byrne gives us two panels to explain how people can see Superman and see Clark Kent and not understand that they're the same people. And what they do is Clark slicks his hair back. He puts on an old pair of Jonathan's spectacles. And Jonathan says, all he needs to do is stoop a tad and he looks to be a whole different man. And so long as he's careful never to let on that he has two separate identities, he'll be able to move freely like ordinary folks. And Clark even calls it, he says, it's lucky I didn't get a chance to tell anyone my name after I saved the shuttle. Now with a few minor alterations, I can have a private place where no one will ever think to look for me. A fortress of solitude, so to speak. And so Superman will look like Clark Kent used to look, except for now he's got a spit curl, as they call it. And then Clark Kent, the new look of Clark Kent will be a hair slicked back with glasses, and he stoops a bit, and he's got an aw shucks kind of attitude. And that's why nobody believes there's no way that guy could be Superman.
What Kent wears, the glasses, the business suit, that's the costume.
But the main thing I wanted to point out here is that Clark strips off his clothes and puts on the costume in front of his parents. And I find that to be kind of weird. I mean, he doesn't get naked. I'm assuming he's wearing some underpants. And I'm sure there are families that are fine walking around in their underwear in front of each other. My family was never quite like that. So maybe I'm a bit of a prude that way. I don't know. I just find it kind of weird that he strips down to his underpants and puts on his costume as his parents are just sitting there in the room with him. I don't know. Found that weird. But that's the issue. I rather enjoyed it this time around again. I don't know how many times I've read the Man of Steel series, but I've read it a number of times. I continually throughout the years, I sit down and say, all right, I'm going to start this John Byrne Superman run again. And gosh darn it, I'm going to finish it this time. And then I never do.
I want the name of this flying whatchamacallit to go with the Daily Planet like bacon and eggs, franks and beans, death and taxes, politics and corruption.
I don't think that he would lend himself to any cheap promotion schemes, though, Mr. White.
But yeah, folks, that is all that I have to say about the Man of Steel number one. What did you guys think? Was this your first time reading through this issue? Email me at thecomicbookshowpodcast@gmail.com. And who knows, I just might read it out on a future episode. For now, however, it's time for episode one to come to a close. And so I present to you all of the ending bits.
And that concludes our broadcast day.
Next time on The Comic Book Show, Superman begins his career in Metropolis, and Lois Lane pulls out all the stops to get an interview with the Man of Steel, including driving her car off the end of a pier. All that and more in our second episode as we look at the Man of Steel number 2 from July of 1986, The Story of the Century. Until then, folks, if you ever see a mysterious stranger drop out of the sky carrying a space shuttle on his back, leave him alone. I mean, Great Caesar's ghost, people. Don't pester the poor man with questions or demands. Just let him do his thing. Bye. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of The Comic Book Show. Questions and comments can be directed to thecomicbookshowpodcast@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can help to boost our presence online by leaving a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. I also invite you to join our subscription program, Steven or Else Beyond. And in return, you'll have access to binge full seasons of The Comic Book Show all at once, early and ad-free. You can subscribe to Steven or Else Beyond through Apple Podcasts, Patreon, or Substack. Check out the link in your show notes or just go to thecomicbookshowpodcast.com to choose the option that's best for you. The Comic Book Show is a presentation of Steven or Else Media. For more nerdy content hosted by me, check out StephenOrElse.com. The synopsis used in this episode comes from Mike's Amazing World of Comics at Mike'sAmazingWorld.com. Superman is a registered trademark of DC Comics and was created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster.
Well, I certainly hope this little incident hasn't put you off flying, miss. Statistically speaking, of course, it's still the safest way to travel.
You're listening to... I'm your host. My name is Steven, and I want to thank you. Yeah, you. I'm talking to you right there, standing there with your hands in your pockets. Well, you got one hand in your pocket, and the other one's holding a cigarette. Zibbity bing bong bing bing. This was, of course, Crisis on Infinite Earths, and the Man of Steel mini series. In each episode, I'll give you a short synopsis of the issue before I really dive in and poop all over whatever may be in the vicinity. Disturbing. In each episode, I'll give you a short synopsis of the issue before I really dive in, going page by page. Page by page, that's a way to do it with the people who you love. This is the opening theme song to a lame 80s sitcom that I'm making up. Page by page. Going page by page and comb through the story. I'm having a really hard time with like this one freaking sentence. It's a stupid sentence.
I just don't think I can move through life knowing that a guy named Steven did this to me.
Oh, but wait, there's Superman. He'll save us. Superman! Superman! Wait, where are you going? What the hell with him?
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.